empty cars and piles of suddenly immovable ore. The men of the railroad and of the mine stopped in dazed bewilderment. They found that in all the complexity of their equipment, among the drills, the motors, the derricks, the delicate gauges, the ponderous floodlights beating down into the pits and ridges of a mountain, there was no wire to mend the crane. They stopped, like men on an ocean liner propelled by 10,000-horsepower generators, but perishing for lack of a safety pin. The station agent, a young man with a swift body and a brusque voice, stripped the wiring from the station building and set the crane in motion again. And while the ore went clattering to fill the cars, the light of candles came trembling through the dusk from the windows of the station. "Minnesota, Eddie," said Dagny grimly, closing the drawer of her special file. "Tell the Minnesota division to ship half their stock of wire to Montana." "But good God, Dagny, with the peak of the harvest rush approaching, they'll hold through it, I think. We don't dare lose a single supplier of copper." "But I have," screamed James Taggart, when she reminded him once more. "I have obtained for you the top priority on copper wire, the first claim, the uppermost ration level. I've given you all the cards, certificates, documents, and requisitions. What else do you want?" "The copper wire." "I've done all I could. Nobody can blame me." She did not argue. The afternoon newspaper was lying on his desk, and she was staring at an item on the back page. An emergency state tax had been passed in California for the relief of the state's unemployed in the amount of 50% of any local corporation's gross income ahead of other taxes. The California oil companies had gone out of business. "Don't worry, Mr. Reardon," said an unctuous voice over a long-distance telephone line from Washington. "I just wanted to assure you that you will not have to worry." "About what?" asked Reardon, baffled. "About that temporary bit of confusion in California. We'll straighten it out in no time. It was an act of illegal insurrection. Their state government had no right to impose local taxes detrimental to national taxes. We'll negotiate an equitable arrangement immediately. But in the meantime, if you have been disturbed by any unpatriotic rumors about the California oil companies, I just wanted to tell you that Reardon Steel has been placed in the top category of essential need, with first claim upon any oil available anywhere in the nation. Very top category, Mr. Reardon. So I just wanted you to know that you won't have to worry about the problem of fuel this winter." Reardon hung up the telephone receiver with a frown of worry, not about the problem of fuel and the end of the California oil fields. Disasters of this kind had become habitual, but about the fact that the Washington planners found it necessary to placate him. This was new. He wondered what it meant. Through the years of his struggle, he had learned that an apparently causeless antagonism was not hard to deal with, but an apparently causeless solicitude was an ugly danger. The same wonder struck him again when, walking down an alley between the mill structures, he caught sight of a slouching figure whose posture combined an air of insolence with an air of expecting to be swatted. It was his brother Philip. Ever since he had moved to Philadelphia, Reardon had not visited his former home and had not heard a word from his family, whose bills he went on paying. Then inexplicably, twice in the last few weeks, he had caught Philip wandering through the mills for no apparent reason. He had been unable to tell whether Philip was sneaking to avoid him or waiting to catch his attention. It had looked like both. He had been unable to discover any clue to Philip's purpose, only some incomprehensible solicitude of a kind Philip had never displayed before. The first time, in answer to his startled, "What are you doing here?" Philip had said vaguely, "Well, I know that you don't like me to come to your office." "What do you want?"
"Oh, nothing.
But, well, Mother is worried about you."
"Mother can call me any time she wishes."
Philip had not answered, but had proceeded to question him in an unconvincingly casual manner about his work, his health, his business. The questions had kept hitting oddly beside the point, not questions about business, but more about his Reardon's feelings toward business. Reardon had cut him short and waved him away, but had been left with the small, nagging sense of an incident that remained inexplicable. The second time, Philip had said, as sole explanation, "We just want to know how you feel." "Who's we?"
"Why,
Mother and I. These are difficult times, and,
well, Mother wants to know how you feel about it all."
"Tell her that I don't." The words had seemed to hit Philip in some peculiar manner, almost as if this were the one answer he dreaded. "Get out of here," Reardon had ordered wearily, "and the next time you want to see me, make an appointment and come to my office. But don't come unless you have something to say. This is not a place where one discusses feelings, mine or anybody else's." Philip had not called for an appointment, but now there he was again, slouching among the giant shapes of the furnaces, with an air of guilt and snobbishness together, as if he were both snooping and slumming. "But I do have something to say. I do," he cried hastily, in answer to the angry frown on Reardon's face. "Why didn't you come to my office? You don't want me in your office. I don't want you here either. But I'm only trying to be considerate and not to take your time when you're so busy, and you are very busy, aren't you?"
"And?"
"And, well, I just wanted to catch you in a spare moment, to talk to you."
"About what?"
I need a job." He said it belligerently and drew back a little. Reardon stood looking at him blankly. "Henry, I want a job. I mean here, at the mills. I want you to give me something to do. I need a job. I need to earn my living. I'm tired of alms." He was groping for something to say, his voice both offended and pleading, as if the necessity to justify the plea were an unfair imposition upon him. "I want a livelihood of my own. I'm not asking you for charity. I'm asking you to give me a chance."
"This is a factory, Philip, not a gambling joint."
"Huh?"
"We don't take chances or give them."
"I'm asking you to give me a job."
"Why should I?"
"Because I need it." Reardon pointed to the red spurts of flame shooting from the black shape of a furnace, shooting safely into space 400 feet of steel, clay, and steam-embodied thought above them.
"I needed that furnace, Philip. It wasn't my need that gave it to me."
Philip's face assumed a look of not having heard. "You're not officially supposed to hire anybody, but that's just a technicality. If you'll put me on, my friends will okay it without any trouble, and—"
Something about Reardon's eyes made him stop abruptly, then ask in an angrily impatient voice,
"Well, what's the matter? What have I said that's wrong?"
"What you haven't said."
"I beg your pardon?"
"What you're squirming to leave unmentioned."
"What?"
"That you'd be of no use to me whatever."
"Is that what you—"
Philip started with automatic righteousness, but stopped and did not finish.
"Yes," said Reardon, smiling.
"That's what I think of first."
Philip's eyes oozed away. When he spoke, his voice sounded as if it were darting about at random, picking stray sentences. "Everybody is entitled to a livelihood. How am I going to get it if nobody gives me my chance?"
"How did I get mine?"
"I wasn't born owning a steel plant."
"Was I?"
"I can do anything you can, if you'll teach me."
"Who taught me?"
"Why do you keep saying that? I'm not talking about you."
"I am."
In a moment, Philip muttered, "What do you have to worry about? It's not your livelihood that's in question."
Reardon pointed to the figures of men in the steaming rays of the furnace. "Can you do what they're doing?"
"I don't see what you're—"
"What will happen if I put you there and you ruin a heat of steel for me?"
"What's more important, that your damn steel gets poured or that I eat?"
"How do you propose to eat if the steel doesn't get poured?"
Philip's face assumed a look of reproach. "I'm not in a position to argue with you right now since you hold the upper hand."
"Then don't argue."
"Huh?"
Keep your mouth shut and get out of here.
But I meant...
He stopped. Reardon chuckled. You meant that it's I who should keep my mouth shut because I hold the upper hand and should give in to you because you hold no hand at all?
That's a peculiarly crude way of stating a moral principle.
But that's what your moral principle amounts to, doesn't it? You can't discuss morality in materialistic terms. We're discussing a job in a steel plant, and boy, is that a materialistic place. Philip's body drew a shade tighter together, and his eyes became a shade more glazed, as if in fear of the place around him, in resentment of its sight, in an effort not to concede its reality. He said, in the soft, stubborn whine of a voodoo incantation, "It's a moral imperative, universally conceded in our day and age, that every man is entitled to a job." His voice rose. "I'm entitled to it."
"You are? Go on, then. Collect your claim."
"Huh?"
"Collect your job. Pick it off the bush where you think it grows."
"I mean..."
"You mean that it doesn't? You mean that you need it but can't create it? You mean that you're entitled to a job which I must create for you?"
"Yes."
"And if I don't?" The silence went stretching through second after second.
"I don't understand you," said Philip.
His voice had the angry bewilderment of a man who recites the formulas of a well-tested role but keeps getting the wrong cues in answer.
"I don't understand why one can't talk to you anymore. I don't understand what sort of theory you're propounding and..."
"Oh, yes, you do." As if refusing to believe that the formulas could fail, Philip burst out with, "Since when did you take to abstract philosophy? You're only a businessman. You're not qualified to deal with questions of principle. You ought to leave it to the experts who have conceded for centuries."
"Cut it, Philip. What's the gimmick?"
"Gimmick?
Why the sudden ambition?"
"Well, at a time like this..."
"Like what?"
"Well, every man has the right to have some means of support and not be left to be tossed aside. When things are so uncertain, a man's got to have some security, some foothold. I mean, at a time like this, if anything happened to you, I'd have no..."
"What do you expect to happen to me?"
"Oh, I don't. I don't."
The cry was oddly, incomprehensibly genuine.
"I don't expect anything to happen. Do you?"
"Such as what?"
"How do I know? But I've got nothing except the pittance you give me, and you might change your mind any time."
"I might.
And I haven't any hold on you at all."
"Why did it take you that many years to realize it and start worrying? Why now?"
Because you've changed. You used to have a sense of duty and moral responsibility, but you're losing it. You're losing it, aren't you?"
Reardon stood studying him silently. There was something peculiar in Philip's manner of sliding toward questions, as if his words were accidental, but the too casual, the faintly insistent questions were the key to his purpose.
"Well, I'll be glad to take the burden off your shoulders if I'm a burden to you," Philip snapped suddenly. "Just give me a job, and your conscience won't have to bother you about me any longer."
"It doesn't."
"That's what I mean. You don't care. You don't care what becomes of any of us, do you?"
"Of whom?"
"Why, Mother and me and mankind in general. But I'm not going to appeal to your better self. I know that you're ready to ditch me at a moment's notice, so..."
"You're lying, Philip. That's not what you're worried about. If it were, you'd be angling for a chunk of cash, not for a job. Not..."
"No, I want a job."
The cry was immediate and almost frantic.
"Don't try to buy me off with cash. I want a job."
"Pull yourself together, you poor louse. Do you hear what you're saying?"
Philip spit out his answer with impotent hatred.
You can't talk to me that way. Can you?
I only... To buy you off. Why should I try to buy you off, instead of kicking you out as I should have years ago?
Well, after all, I'm your brother.
What is that supposed to mean? One's supposed to have some sort of feeling for one's brother.
Do you?
Philip's mouth swelled petulantly. He did not answer. He waited. Reardon let him wait. Philip muttered,
You're supposed, at least, to have some consideration for my feelings.
But you haven't.
Have you for mine?
Yours?
Your feelings?
It was not malice in Philip's voice, but worse. It was a genuine, indignant astonishment.
You haven't any feelings. You've never felt anything at all. You've never suffered.
It was as if a sum of years hit Reardon in the face by means of a sensation and a sight. The exact sensation of what he had felt in the cab of the first train's engine on the John Galt line, and the sight of Philip's eyes, the pale, half-liquid eyes presenting the uttermost of human degradation, an uncontested pain, and with the obscene insolence of a skeleton toward a living being, demanding that this pain be held as the highest of values.
You've never suffered, the eyes were saying to him accusingly, while he was seeing the night in his office when his ore mines were taken away from him, the moment when he had signed the gift certificate surrendering Reardon metal, the month of days inside a plane that searched for the remains of Dagny's body.
You've never suffered, the eyes were saying with self-righteous scorn, while he remembered the sensation of proud chastity with which he had fought through those moments, refusing to surrender to pain, a sensation made of his love, of his loyalty, of his knowledge that joy is the goal of existence, and joy is not to be stumbled upon, but to be achieved, and the act of treason is to let its vision drown in the swamp of the moment's torture.
You've never suffered, the dead stare of the eyes was saying. You've never felt anything, because only to suffer is to feel. There's no such thing as joy. There's only pain and the absence of pain. Only pain and the zero when one feels nothing.
I suffer. I'm twisted by suffering. I'm made of undiluted suffering. That's my purity. That's my virtue.
And yours, you the untwisted one, you the uncomplaining, yours is to relieve me of my pain.
Cut your unsuffering body to patch up mine. Cut your unfeeling soul to stop mine from feeling. And we'll achieve the ultimate ideal, the triumph over life, the zero.
He was seeing the nature of those who for centuries had not recoiled from the preachers of annihilation. He was seeing the nature of the enemies he had been fighting all his life.
Philip, he said, get out of here.
His voice was like a ray of sunlight in a morgue. It was the plain, dry, daily voice of a businessman, the sound of health, addressed to an enemy one could not honor by anger, nor even by horror. And don't ever try to enter these mills again, because there will be orders at every gate to throw you out if you try it.
Well, after all, said Philip, in the angry and cautious tone of a tentative threat, I could have my friends assign me to a job here and compel you to accept it.
Reardon had started to go, but he stopped and turned to look at his brother. Philip's moment of grasping a sudden revelation was not accomplished by means of thought, but by means of that dark sensation which was his only mode of consciousness. He felt a sensation of terror squeezing his throat, shivering down into his stomach. He was seeing the spread of the mills, with the roving streamers of flame, with the ladles of molten metal sailing through space on delicate cables, with open pits the color of glowing coal, with cranes coming at his head, pounding past, holding tons of steel by the invisible power of magnets. And he knew that he was afraid of this place, afraid to the death, that he dared not move without the protection and guidance of the man before him. Then he looked at the tall, straight figure standing casually still, the figure with the unflinching eyes whose sight had cut through rock and flame to build this place. And then he knew how easily the man he was proposing to compel could let a single bucket of metal tilt over a second ahead of its time, or let a single crane drop its load a foot short of its goal, and there would be nothing left of him, of Philip the Claimant. And his only protection lay in the fact that his mind would think of such actions, but the mind of Hank Reardon would not.
"But we'd better keep it on a friendly basis," said Philip.
"You'd better," said Reardon, and walked away. "Men who worship pain," thought Reardon, staring at the image of the enemies he had never been able to understand. "They're men who worship pain." It seemed monstrous, yet peculiarly devoid of importance. He felt nothing. It was like trying to summon emotion toward inanimate objects, toward refuse sliding down a mountainside to crush him. One could flee from the slide or build retaining walls against it or be crushed. But one could not grant any anger, indignation, or moral concern to the senseless motions of the unliving. No, worse, he thought, the anti-living. The same sense of detached unconcern remained with him while he sat in a Philadelphia courtroom and watched men perform the motions which were to grant him his divorce. He watched them utter mechanical generalities, recite vague phrases of fraudulent evidence, play an intricate game of stretching words to convey no facts and no meaning. He had paid them to do it. He, whom the law permitted no other way to gain his freedom, no right to state the facts and plead the truth. The law which delivered his fate, not to objective rules objectively defined, but to the arbitrary mercy of a judge with a wizened face and a look of empty cunning. Lillian was not present in the courtroom. Her attorney made gestures once in a while, with the energy of letting water run through his fingers. They all knew the verdict in advance, and they knew its reason. No other reason had existed for years, where no standards save whim had existed. They seemed to regard it as their rightful prerogative. They acted as if the purpose of the procedure were not to try a case, but to give them jobs, as if their jobs were to recite the appropriate formulas with no responsibility to know what the formulas accomplished, as if a courtroom were the one place where questions of right and wrong were irrelevant, and they, the men in charge of dispensing justice, were safely wise enough to know that no justice existed. They acted like savages performing a ritual devised to set them free of objective reality. But the 10 years of his marriage had been real, he thought, and these were the men who assumed the power to dispose of it, to decide whether he would have a chance of contentment on earth or be condemned to torture for the rest of his lifetime. He remembered the austerely pitiless respect he had felt for his contract of marriage, for all his contracts and all his legal obligations, and he saw what sort of legality his scrupulous observance was expected to serve. He noticed that the puppets of the courtroom had started by glancing at him in the sly, wise manner of fellow conspirators sharing a common guilt, mutually safe from moral condemnation. Then, when they observed that he was the only man in the room who looked steadily straight at anyone's face, he saw resentment growing in their eyes. Incredulously, he realized what it was that had been expected of him. He, the victim, chained, bound, gagged, and left with no recourse save to bribery, had been expected to believe that the farce he had purchased was a process of law, that the edicts enslaving him had moral validity, that he was guilty of corrupting the integrity of the guardians of justice, and that the blame was his, not theirs. It was like blaming the victim of a holdup for corrupting the integrity of the thug. And yet, he thought, through all the generations of political extortion, it was not the looting bureaucrats who had taken the blame, but the chained industrialists. Not the men who peddled legal favors, but the men who were forced to buy them. And through all those generations of crusades against corruption, the remedy had always been not the liberating of the victims, but the granting of wider powers for extortion to the extortionists.
The only guilt of the victims, he thought, had been that they accepted it as guilt.
When he walked out of the courtroom into the chilly drizzle of a gray afternoon, he felt as if he had been divorced not only from Lillian, but from the whole of the human society that supported the procedure he had witnessed. The face of his attorney, an elderly man of the old-fashioned school, wore an expression that made it look as if he longed to take a bath.
"Say, Hank," he asked as sole comment, "is there something the looters are anxious to get from you right now?"
"Not that I know of. Why?"
"The thing went too smoothly. There were a few points at which I expected pressure and hints for some extras, but the boys sailed past and took no advantage of it. Looks to me as if orders had come from on high to treat you gently and let you have your way. Are they planning something new against your mills?"
"Not that I know of," said Reardon, and was astonished to hear in his mind, "Not that I care."
It was on the same afternoon at the mills that he saw the wet nurse hurrying toward him, a gangling, coltish figure with a peculiar mixture of brusqueness, awkwardness, and decisiveness.
"Mr. Reardon, I would like to speak to you."
His voice was diffident, yet oddly firm.
"Go ahead."
"There's something I want to ask you."
The boy's face was solemn and taut.
"I want you to know that I know you should refuse me, but I want to ask it just the same, and if it's presumptuous, then just tell me to go to hell."
"Okay. Try it."
"Mr. Reardon, would you give me a job?"
It was the effort to sound normal that betrayed the days of struggle behind the question.
"I want to quit what I'm doing and go to work. I mean real work, in steel making, like I thought I'd started to once. I want to earn my keep. I'm tired of being a bedbug."
Reardon could not resist smiling and reminding him, in the tone of a quotation, "Now why use such words, non-absolute? If we don't use ugly words, we won't have any ugliness, and..." But he saw the desperate earnestness of the boy's face and stopped, his smile vanishing.
"I mean it, Mr. Reardon. And I know what the word means, and it's the right word. I'm tired of being paid with your money to do nothing except make it impossible for you to make any money at all. I know that anyone who works today is only a sucker for bastards like me, but, well... God damn it, I'd rather be a sucker, if that's all there's left to be."
His voice had risen to a cry.
"I beg your pardon, Mr. Reardon,"
he said stiffly, looking away. In a moment he went on in his woodenly, unemotional tone.
"I want to get out of the deputy director of distribution racket. I don't know that I'd be of much use to you. I've got a college diploma in metallurgy, but that's not worth the paper it's printed on. But I think I've learned a little about the work in the 2 years I've been here. And if you could use me at all, as sweeper or scrapman or whatever you'd trust me with, I'd tell them where to put the deputy directorship, and I'd go to work for you tomorrow, next week, this minute, or whenever you say."
He avoided looking at Reardon, not in a manner of evasion, but as if he had no right to do it.
"Why were you afraid to ask me?" said Reardon gently.
The boy glanced at him with indignant astonishment, as if the answer were self-evident.
"Because after the way I started here, and the way I acted, and what I'm deputy of, if I come asking you for favors, you ought to kick me in the teeth."
"You have learned a great deal in the 2 years you've been here."
"No, I..."
He glanced at Reardon, understood, looked away, and said woodenly,
"Yeah. If that's what you mean."
"Listen, kid, I'd give you a job this minute, and I'd trust you with more than a sweeper's job if it were up to me. But have you forgotten the unification board? I'm not allowed to hire you, and you're not allowed to quit."
"Sure, men are quitting all the time, and we're hiring others under phony names and fancy papers, proving that they've worked here for years. You know it. And thanks for keeping your mouth shut."
But do you think that if I hired you that way, your friends in Washington would miss it? The boy shook his head slowly. Do you think that if you quit their service to become a sweeper, they wouldn't understand your reason? The boy nodded. Would they let you go? The boy shook his head. After a moment, he said in a tone of forlorn astonishment,
I hadn't thought of that at all, Mr. Reardon. I forgot them.
I kept thinking of whether you'd want me or not, and that the only thing that counted was your decision.
I know. And it is the only thing that counts, in fact.
Yes, non-absolute. In fact. The boy's mouth jerked suddenly into the brief, mirthless twist of a smile.
I guess I'm tied worse than any sucker.
Yes. There's nothing you can do now except apply to the Unification Board for permission to change your job. I'll support your application if you want to try. Only I don't think they'll grant it. I don't think they'll let you work for me.
No, they won't.
If you maneuver enough and lie enough, they might permit you to transfer to a private job with some other steel company.
No. I don't want to go anywhere else. I don't want to leave this place.
He stood looking off at the invisible vapor of rain over the flame of the furnaces. After a while, he said quietly,
I'd better stay put, I guess. I'd better go on being a deputy looter. Besides, if I left, God only knows what sort of bastard they'd saddle you with in my place.
He turned.
They're up to something, Mr. Reardon. I don't know what it is, but they're getting ready to spring something on you.
What?
I don't know, but they've been watching every opening here in the last few weeks, every desertion, and slipping their own gang in. A queer sort of gang, too. Real goons, some of them, that I'd swear never stepped inside a steel plant before. I've had orders to get as many of our boys in as possible. They wouldn't tell me why. I don't know what it is they're planning. I've tried to pump them, but they're acting pretty cagey about it. I don't think they trust me anymore. I'm losing the right touch, I guess. All I know is they're getting set to pull something here.
Thanks for warning me.
I'll try to get the dope on it. I'll try my damnedest to get it in time.
He turned brusquely and started off, but stopped.
Mr. Reardon, if it were up to you, you would have hired me?
I would have, gladly and at once.
Thank you, Mr. Reardon, he said,
his voice solemn and low, then walked away. Reardon stood looking after him, seeing, with a tearing smile of pity, what it was that the ex-relativist, the ex-pragmatist, the ex-amoralist was carrying away with him for consolation. On the afternoon of September 11th, a copper wire broke in Minnesota, stopping the belts of a grain elevator at a small country station of Taggart Transcontinental. A flood of wheat was moving down the highways, the roads, the abandoned trails of the countryside, emptying thousands of acres of farmland upon the fragile dams of the railroad stations. It was moving day and night, the first trickles growing into streams, then rivers, then torrents, moving on palsied trucks with coughing tubercular motors, on wagons pulled by the rusty skeletons of starving horses, on carts pulled by oxen, on the nerves and last energy of men who had lived through 2 years of disaster for the triumphant reward of this autumn's giant harvest, men who had patched their trucks and carts with wire, blankets, ropes, and sleepless nights to make them hold together for this one more journey, to carry the grain and collapse at destination, but to give their owners a chance at survival. Every year at this season, another movement had gone clicking across the country, drawing freight cars from all corners of the continent to the Minnesota division of Taggart Transcontinental, the beat of train wheels preceding the creak of the wagons, like an advance echo rigorously planned, ordered, and timed to meet the flood.
The Minnesota division drowsed through the year to come to violent life for the weeks of the harvest. 14,000 freight cars had jammed its yards each year. 15,000 were expected this time. The first of the wheat trains had started to channel the flood into the hungry flour mills, then bakeries, then stomachs of the nation. But every train, car, and storage elevator counted, and there was no minute or inch of space to spare. Eddie Willers watched Dagny's face as she went through the cards of her emergency file. He could tell the content of the cards by her expression. "The terminal," she said quietly, closing the file. "Phone the terminal downstairs and have them ship half their stock of wire to Minnesota." Eddie said nothing and obeyed. He said nothing the morning when he put on her desk a telegram from the Taggart office in Washington, informing them of the directive which, due to the critical shortage of copper, ordered government agents to seize all copper mines and operate them as a public utility. "Well," she said, dropping the telegram into the wastebasket, "that's the end of Montana." She said nothing when James Taggart announced to her that he was issuing an order to discontinue all dining cars on Taggart trains. "We can't afford it any longer," he explained. "We've always lost money on those goddamn diners. And when there's no food to get, when restaurants are closing because they can't grab hold of a pound of horse meat anywhere, how can railroads be expected to do it? Why in hell should we have to feed the passengers anyway? They're lucky if we give them transportation. They'd travel in cattle cars if necessary. Let them pack their own lunch boxes. What do we care? They've got no other trains to take." The telephone on her desk had become not a voice of business, but an alarm siren for the desperate appeals of disaster. "Miss Taggart, we have no copper wire." "Nails, Miss Taggart, plain nails. Could you tell somebody to send us a keg of nails? Can you find any paint, Miss Taggart? Any sort of waterproof paint anywhere?" But $30 million of subsidy money from Washington had been plowed into Project Soybean, an enormous acreage in Louisiana where a harvest of soybeans was ripening, as advocated and organized by Emma Chalmers, for the purpose of reconditioning the dietary habits of the nation. Emma Chalmers, better known as Kip's Ma, was an old sociologist who had hung about Washington for years, as other women of her age and type hang about barrooms. For some reason which nobody could define, the death of her son in the tunnel catastrophe had given her in Washington an aura of martyrdom, heightened by her recent conversion to Buddhism. "The soybean is a much more sturdy, nutritious, and economical plant than all the extravagant foods which our wasteful, self-indulgent diet has conditioned us to expect," Kip's Ma had said over the radio. Her voice always sounded as if it were falling in drops, not of water, but of mayonnaise. "Soybeans make an excellent substitute for bread, meat, cereals, and coffee. And if all of us were compelled to adopt soybeans as our staple diet, it would solve the national food crisis and make it possible to feed more people. The greatest food for the greatest number, that's my slogan. At a time of desperate public need, it's our duty to sacrifice our luxurious tastes and eat our way back to prosperity by adapting ourselves to the simple, wholesome foodstuff on which the peoples of the Orient have so nobly subsisted for centuries. There's a great deal that we could learn from the peoples of the Orient." "Copper tubing, Miss Taggart, could you get some copper tubing for us somewhere?" the voices were pleading over her telephone. "Rail spikes, Miss Taggart. Screwdrivers, Miss Taggart. Light bulbs, Miss Taggart. There's no electric light bulbs to be had anywhere within 200 miles of us." But $5 million was being spent by the Office of Morale Conditioning on the People's Opera Company, which traveled through the country, giving free performances to people who, on one meal a day, could not afford the energy to walk to the opera house. $7 million had been granted to a psychologist in charge of a project to solve the world crisis by research into the nature of brother love. $10 million had been granted to the manufacturer of a new electronic cigarette lighter, but there were no cigarettes in the shops of the country. There were flashlights on the market, but no batteries. There were radios, but no tubes. There were cameras, but no film. The production of airplanes had been declared temporarily suspended. Air travel for private purposes had been forbidden and reserved exclusively for missions of public need. An industrialist traveling to save his factory was not considered as publicly needed and could not get aboard a plane. An official traveling to collect taxes was, and could. "People are stealing nuts and bolts out of rail plates, Miss Taggart, stealing them at night, and our stock is running out. The division storehouse is bare. What are we to do, Miss Taggart?" But a super-color, 4-foot screen television set was being erected for tourists in a People's Park in Washington, and a super-cyclotron for the study of cosmic rays was being erected at the State Science Institute, to be completed in 10 years. "The trouble with our modern world," Dr. Robert Stadler said over the radio at the ceremonies launching the construction of the cyclotron, "is that too many people think too much. It is the cause of all our current fears and doubts. An enlightened citizenry should abandon the superstitious worship of logic and the outmoded reliance on reason. Just as laymen leave medicine to doctors and electronics to engineers, so people who are not qualified to think should leave all thinking to the experts and have faith in the experts' higher authority. Only experts are able to understand the discoveries of modern science, which have proved that thought is an illusion and that the mind is a myth. This age of misery is God's punishment to man for the sin of relying on his mind," snarled the triumphant voices of mystics of every sect and sort, on street corners, in rain-soaked tents, in crumbling temples. "This world ordeal is the result of man's attempt to live by reason. This is where thinking, logic, and science have brought you. And there's to be no salvation until men realize that their mortal mind is impotent to solve their problems and go back to faith, faith in God, faith in a higher authority." And confronting her daily, there was the final product of it all, the heir and collector, Cuffy Meggs, the man impervious to thought. Cuffy Meggs strode through the offices of Taggart Transcontinental, wearing a semi-military tunic and slapping a shiny leather briefcase against his shiny leather leggings. He carried an automatic pistol in one pocket and a rabbit's foot in the other. Cuffy Meggs tried to avoid her. His manner was part scorn, as if he considered her an impractical idealist, part superstitious awe, as if she possessed some incomprehensible power with which he preferred not to tangle. He acted as if her presence did not belong to his view of a railroad, yet as if hers were the one presence he dared not challenge. There was a touch of impatient resentment in his manner toward Jim, as if it were Jim's duty to deal with her and to protect him. Just as he expected Jim to keep the railroad in running order and leave him free for activities of more practical a nature, so he expected Jim to keep her in line as part of the equipment. Beyond the window of her office, like a patch of adhesive plaster stuck over a wound on the sky, the page of the calendar hung blank in the distance. The calendar had never been repaired since the night of Francisco's farewell. The officials who had rushed to the tower that night had knocked the calendar's motor to a stop while tearing the film out of the projector. They had found the small square of Francisco's message, pasted into the strip of numbered days. But who had pasted it there? Who had entered the locked room, and when and how, was never discovered by the three commissions still investigating the case. Pending the outcome of their efforts, the page hung blank and still above the city. It was blank on the afternoon of September 14th when the telephone rang in her office. "A man from Minnesota," said the voice of her secretary. She had told her secretary that she would accept all calls of this kind. They were the appeals for help and her only source of information. At a time when the voices of railroad officials uttered nothing but sounds designed to avoid communication, the voices of nameless men were her last link to the system, the last sparks of reason and tortured honesty flashing briefly through the miles of Taggart track.
"Miss Taggart, it is not my place to call you, but nobody else will," said the voice that came on the wire this time. The voice sounded young and too calm. "In another day or two, a disaster's going to happen here, the like of which they've never seen. And they won't be able to hide it any longer, only it will be too late by then. and maybe it's too late already. What is it? Who are you?
One of your employees of the Minnesota division, Miss Taggart? In another day or two, the trains will stop running out of here. And you know what that means? At the height of the harvest? At the height of the biggest harvest we've ever had? They'll stop, because we have no cars. The harvest freight cars have not been sent to us this year.
What did you say?
She felt as if minutes went by between the words of the unnatural voice that did not sound like her own.
The cars have not been sent. 15,000 should have been here by now. As far as I could learn, about 8,000 cars is all we got. I've been calling division headquarters for a week. They've been telling me not to worry. Last time they told me to mind my own damn business. Every shed, silo, elevator, warehouse, garage, and dance hall along the track is filled with wheat. At the Sherman elevators, there's a line of farmers, trucks, and wagons 2 miles long waiting on the road. At Lakewood Station, the square is packed solid and has been for 3 nights. They keep telling us it's only temporary. The cars are coming and we'll catch up. We won't. There aren't any cars coming. I've called everyone I could. I know by the way they answer. They know, and not one of them wants to admit it. They're scared. Scared to move or speak or ask or answer. All they're thinking of is who will be blamed when that harvest rots here around the stations, and not of who's going to move it. Maybe nobody can now. Maybe there's nothing you can do about it either. But I thought you're the only person left who'd want to know, and that somebody had to tell you.
She made an effort to breathe.
I see. Who are you? The name wouldn't matter. When I hang up, I will have become a deserter. I don't want to stay here to see it when it happens. I don't want any part of it anymore. Good luck to you, Miss Taggart.
She heard the click.
Thank you, she said over a dead wire.
The next time she noticed the office around her and permitted herself to feel, it was noon of the following day. She stood in the middle of the office, running stiff, spread fingers through a strand of hair, brushing it back off her face, and for an instant she wondered where she was and what was the unbelievable thing that had happened in the last 20 hours. What she felt was horror, and she knew that she had felt it from the first words of the man on the wire, only there had been no time to know it. There was not much that remained in her mind of the last 20 hours, only disconnected bits, held together by the single constant that had made them possible, by the soft, loose faces of men who fought to hide from themselves that they knew the answers to the questions she asked. From the moment when she was told that the manager of the car service department had been out of town for a week and had left no address where one could reach him, she knew that the report of the man from Minnesota was true. Then came the faces of the assistants in the car service department, who would neither confirm the report nor deny it, but kept showing her papers, orders, forms, file cards that bore words in the English language, but no connection to intelligible facts. Were the freight cars sent to Minnesota? Form 357W was filled out in every particular, as required by the Office of the Coordinator in conformance with the instructions of the Comptroller and by Directive 11-493. Were the freight cars sent to Minnesota? The entries for the month of August and September have been processed by... Were the freight cars sent to Minnesota? My files indicate the locations of freight cars by state, date, classification, and... Do you know whether the cars were sent to Minnesota? As to the interstate motion of freight cars, I would have to refer you to the files of Mr. Benson and of... There was nothing to learn from the files. There were careful entries, each conveying 4 possible meanings, with references which led to references which led to a final reference which was missing from the files. It did not take her long to discover that the cars had not been sent to Minnesota, and that the order had come from Cuffy Meggs.
But who had carried it out? Who had tangled the trail? What steps had been taken by what compliant men to preserve the appearance of a safely normal operation, without a single cry of protest to arouse some braver man's attention? Who had falsified the reports and where the cars had gone? Seemed at first impossible to learn. Through the hours of that night, while a small, desperate crew under the command of Eddie Willers kept calling every division point, every yard, depot, station, spur, and siding of Taggart Transcontinental for every freight car in sight or reach, ordering them to unload, drop, dump, scuttle anything, and proceed to Minnesota at once. While they kept calling the yards, stations, and presidents of every railroad still half in existence anywhere across the map, begging for cars for Minnesota, she went through the task of tracing from face to coward's face the destination of the freight cars that had vanished. She went from railroad executives to wealthy shippers to Washington officials and back to the railroad, by cab, by phone, by wire, pursuing a trail of half-uttered hints. The trail approached its end when she heard the pinch-lipped voice of a public relations woman in a Washington office, saying resentfully over the telephone wire, "Well, after all, it is a matter of opinion whether wheat is essential to a nation's welfare. There are those of more progressive views who feel that the soybean is perhaps of far greater value." And then by noon, she stood in the middle of her office, knowing that the freight cars intended for the wheat of Minnesota had been sent instead to carry the soybeans from the Louisiana swamps of Kip's Ma's project. The first story of the Minnesota disaster appeared in the newspapers 3 days later. It reported that the farmers who had waited in the streets of Lakewood for 6 days, with no place to store their wheat and no trains to carry it, had demolished the local courthouse, the mayor's home, and the railroad station. Then the stories vanished abruptly, and the newspapers kept silent, then began to print admonitions urging people not to believe unpatriotic rumors. While the flour mills and grain markets of the country were screaming over the phones and the telegraph wires, sending pleas to New York and delegations to Washington, while strings of freight cars from random corners of the continent were crawling like rusty caterpillars across the map in the direction of Minnesota, the wheat and hope of the country were waiting to perish along an empty track under the unchanging green lights of signals that called for motion to trains that were not there. At the communication desks of Taggart Transcontinental, a small crew kept calling for freight cars, repeating, like the crew of a sinking ship, an SOS that remained unheard. There were freight cars held loaded for months in the yards of the companies owned by the friends of pole peddlers, who ignored the frantic demands to unload the cars and release them. "You can tell that railroad," followed by untransmissible words, was the message of the Smather Brothers of Arizona in answer to the SOS of New York. In Minnesota, they were seizing cars from every siding, from the Mesabi Range, from the ore mines of Paul Larkin, where the cars had stood waiting for a dribble of iron. They were pouring wheat into ore cars, into coal cars, into boarded stock cars that went spilling thin gold trickles along the track as they clattered off. They were pouring wheat into passenger coaches, over seats, racks, and fixtures, to send it off, to get it moving, even if it went moving into trackside ditches in the sudden crash of breaking springs, in the explosions set off by burning journal boxes. They fought for movement with no thought of destination, for movement as such, like a paralytic under a stroke, struggling in wild, stiff, incredulous jerks against the realization that movement was suddenly impossible. There were no other railroads. James Taggart had killed them. There were no boats on the lakes. Paul Larkin had destroyed them. There was only the single line of rail and a net of neglected highways. The trucks and wagons of waiting farmers started trickling blindly down the roads, with no maps, no gas, no feed for horses, moving south. South toward the vision of flour mills awaiting them somewhere, with no knowledge of the distances ahead, but with the knowledge of death behind them. Moving to collapse on the roads, in the gullies, in the breaks of rotted bridges.
One farmer was found, half a mile south of the wreck of his truck, lying dead in a ditch, face down, still clutching a sack of wheat on his shoulders. Then rain clouds burst over the prairies of Minnesota. The rain went eating the wheat into rot at the waiting railroad stations. It went hammering the piles spilled along the roads, washing gold kernels into the soil. The men in Washington were last to be reached by the panic. They watched, not the news from Minnesota, but the precarious balance of their friendships and commitments. They weighed, not the fate of the harvest, but the unknowable result of unpredictable emotions in unthinking men of unlimited power. They waited. They evaded all pleas. They declared, "Oh, ridiculous, there's nothing to worry about. Those Taggart people have always moved that wheat on schedule. They'll find some way to move it." Then, when the state chief executive of Minnesota sent a request to Washington for the assistance of the army against the riots he was unable to control, three directives burst forth within 2 hours, stopping all trains in the country, commandeering all cars to speed to Minnesota. An order signed by Wesley Mouch demanded the immediate release of the freight cars held in the service of Kip's Ma. But by that time, it was too late. Ma's freight cars were in California, where the soybeans had been sent to a progressive concern made up of sociologists preaching the cult of Oriental austerity and of businessmen formerly in the numbers racket. In Minnesota, farmers were setting fire to their own farms. They were demolishing grain elevators and the homes of county officials. They were fighting along the track of the railroad, some to tear it up, some to defend it with their lives. And with no goal to reach save violence, they were dying in the streets of gutted towns and in the silent gullies of a roadless night. Then there was only the acrid stench of grain rotting in half-smoldering piles, a few columns of smoke rising from the plains, standing still in the air over blackened ruins, and in an office in Pennsylvania, Hank Reardon sitting at his desk, looking at a list of men who had gone bankrupt. They were the manufacturers of farm equipment, who could not be paid, and would not be able to pay him. The harvest of soybeans did not reach the markets of the country. It had been reaped prematurely. It was moldy and unfit for consumption. On the night of October 15th, a copper wire broke in New York City, in an underground control tower of the Taggart Terminal, extinguishing the lights of the signals. It was only the breach of one wire, but it produced a short circuit in the interlocking traffic system, and the signals of motion or danger disappeared from the panels of the control towers and from among the strands of rail. The red and green lenses remained red and green, not with the living radiance of sight, but with the dead stare of glass eyes. On the edge of the city, a cluster of trains gathered at the entrance to the terminal tunnels and grew through the minutes of stillness, like blood dammed by a clot inside a vein, unable to rush into the chambers of the heart. Dagny that night was sitting at a table in a private dining room of the Wayne Falkland. The wax of candles was dripping down on the white camellias and laurel leaves at the base of the silver candlesticks. Arithmetical calculations were penciled on the damask linen tablecloth, and a cigar butt was swimming in a finger bowl. The six men in formal dinner jackets, facing her about the table, were Wesley Mouch, Eugene Lawson, Dr. Floyd Ferris, Clem Weatherby, James Taggart, and Cuffy Meggs. "Why?" she had asked when Jim had told her that she had to attend that dinner. "Well, because our board of directors is to meet next week." "And?" "You're interested in what's going to be decided about our Minnesota line, aren't you?"
"Is that going to be decided at the board meeting?"
"Well, not exactly."
"Is it going to be decided at this dinner?"
"Not exactly, but..."
"Oh, why do you always have to be so definite? Nothing's ever definite.
Besides, they insisted that they wanted you to come."
"Why?"
"Isn't that sufficient?" She did not ask why those men chose to make all their crucial decisions at parties of this kind. She knew that they did. She knew that behind the clattering, lumbering pretense of their council sessions, committee meetings, and mass debates, the decisions were made in advance, in furtive informality, at luncheons, dinners, and bars. The graver the issue, the more casual the method of settling it. It was the first time that they had asked her, the outsider, the enemy, to one of those secret sessions. It was, she thought, an acknowledgement of the fact that they needed her and, perhaps, the first step of their surrender. It was a chance she could not leave untaken. But as she sat in the candlelight of the dining room, she felt certain that she had no chance. She felt restlessly unable to accept that certainty, since she could not grasp its reason, yet lethargically reluctant to pursue any inquiry. As I think you will concede, Miss Taggart, there now seems to be no economic justification for the continued existence of a railroad line in Minnesota, which, and even Miss Taggart will, I'm sure, agree that certain temporary retrenchments seem to be indicated until... Nobody, not even Miss Taggart, will deny that there are times when it is necessary to sacrifice the parts for the sake of the whole. As she listened, the mentions of her name tossed into the conversation at half-hour intervals, tossed perfunctorily, with the speaker's eyes never glancing in her direction, she wondered what motive had made them want her to be present. It was not an attempt to delude her into believing that they were consulting her, but worse, an attempt to delude themselves into believing that she had agreed. They asked her questions at times and interrupted her before she had completed the first sentence of the answer. They seemed to want her approval without having to know whether she approved or not. Some crudely childish form of self-deception had made them choose to give to this occasion the decorous setting of a formal dinner. They acted as if they hoped to gain from the objects of gracious luxury the power and the honor of which those objects had once been the product and symbol. They acted, she thought, like those savages who devour the corpse of an adversary in the hope of acquiring his strength and his virtue. She regretted that she was dressed as she was. "It's formal," Jim had told her, "but don't overdo it. What I mean is don't look too rich. Business people should avoid any appearance of arrogance these days. Not that you should look shabby, but if you could just seem to suggest, well... humility. It would please them, you know. It would make them feel big." "Really," she had said, turning away. She wore a black dress that looked as if it were no more than a piece of cloth crossed over her breasts and falling to her feet in the soft folds of a Grecian tunic. It was made of satin, a satin so light and thin that it could have served as the stuff of a nightgown. The luster of the cloth, streaming and shifting with her movements, made it look as if the light of the room she entered were her personal property, sensitively obedient to the motions of her body, wrapping her in a sheet of radiance more luxurious than the texture of brocade, underscoring the pliant fragility of her figure, giving her an air of so natural an elegance that it could afford to be scornfully casual. She wore a single piece of jewelry, a diamond clip at the edge of the black neckline that kept flashing with the imperceptible motion of her breath, like a transformer converting a flicker into fire, making one conscious not of the gems, but of the living beat behind them. It flashed like a military decoration, like wealth worn as a badge of honor. She wore no other ornament, only the sweep of a black velvet cape, more arrogantly, ostentatiously patrician than any spread of sables. She regretted it now, as she looked at the men before her. She felt the embarrassing guilt of pointlessness, as if she had tried to defy the figures in a waxworks. She saw a mindless resentment in their eyes and a sneaking trace of the lifeless, sexless, smutty leer with which men look at a poster advertising burlesque. "It's a great responsibility," said Eugene Lawson, "to hold the decision of life or death over thousands of people, and to sacrifice them when necessary, but we must have the courage to do it." His soft lips seemed to twist into a smile. "The only factors to consider are land acreage and population figures," said Dr. Ferris in a statistical voice, blowing smoke rings at the ceiling.
Since it is no longer possible to maintain both the Minnesota line and the transcontinental traffic of this railroad, the choice is between Minnesota and those states west of the Rockies, which were cut off by the failure of the Taggart Tunnel, as well as the neighboring states of Montana, Idaho, Oregon, which means, practically speaking, the whole of the Northwest. When you compute the acreage and the number of heads in both areas, it's obvious that we should scuttle Minnesota rather than give up our lines of communication over a third of a continent.
I won't give up the continent,
said Wesley Mouch, staring down at his dish of ice cream, his voice hurt and stubborn. She was thinking of the Mesabi Range, the last of the major sources of iron ore. She was thinking of the Minnesota farmers, such as were left of them, the best producers of wheat in the country. She was thinking that the end of Minnesota would end Wisconsin, then Michigan, then Illinois. She was seeing the red breath of the factories dying out over the industrial east, as against the empty miles of western sands, of scraggly pastures and abandoned ranches.
The figures indicate, said Mr. Weatherby primly, that the continued maintenance of both areas seems to be impossible.
The railway track and equipment of one has to be dismantled to provide the material for the maintenance of the other. She noted that Clem Weatherby, their technical expert on railroads, was the man of least influence among them, and Cuffy Meggs of most. Cuffy Meggs sat sprawled in his chair with a look of patronizing tolerance for their game of wasting time on discussions. He spoke little, but when he did, it was to snap decisively with a contemptuous grin, "Pipe down, Jimmy," or, "Nuts, Wes, you're talking through your hat." She noticed that neither Jim nor Mouch resented it. They seemed to welcome the authority of his assurance. They were accepting him as their master.
"We have to be practical," Dr. Ferris kept saying. "We have to be scientific." "I need the economy of the country as a whole," Wesley Mouch kept repeating. "I need the production of a nation."
"Is it economics that you are talking about? Is it production?" she said, whenever her cold, measured voice was able to seize a brief stretch of their time. "If it is, then give us leeway to save the eastern states. That's all that's left of the country, and of the world. If you let us save that, we'll have a chance to rebuild the rest. If not, it's the end. Let the Atlantic Southern take care of such transcontinental traffic as still exists. Let the local railroads take care of the Northwest. But let Taggart Transcontinental drop everything else, yes, everything, and devote all our resources, equipment, and rail to the traffic of the eastern states. Let us shrink back to the start of this country, but let us hold that start. We'll run no trains west of the Missouri. We'll become a local railroad, the local of the industrial east. Let us save our industries. There's nothing left to save in the West. You can run agriculture for centuries by manual labor and ox carts, but destroy the last of this country's industrial plant, and centuries of effort won't be able to rebuild it or to gather the economic strength to make a start. How do you expect our industries or railroads to survive without steel? How do you expect any steel to be produced if you cut off the supply of iron ore? Save Minnesota, whatever's left of it. The country. You have no country to save if its industries perish. You can sacrifice a leg or an arm. You can't save a body by sacrificing its heart and brain. Save our industries. Save Minnesota. Save the eastern seaboard. It was no use. She said it as many times, with as many details, statistics, figures, proofs as she could force out of her weary mind into their evasive hearing. It was no use. They neither refuted nor agreed. They merely looked as if her arguments were beside the point. There was a sound of hidden emphasis in their answers, as if they were giving her an explanation, but in a code to which she had no key. "There's trouble in California," said Wesley Mouch sullenly. "Their state legislature's been acting pretty huffy. There's talk of seceding from the Union."
"Oregon is overrun by gangs of deserters," said Clem Weatherby cautiously. "They murdered 2 tax collectors within the last 3 months.
The importance of industry to a civilization has been grossly overemphasized,"
said Dr. Ferris dreamily. What is now known as the People's State of India has existed for centuries without any industrial development whatever.
People could do with fewer material gadgets and a sterner discipline of privations, said Eugene Lawson eagerly. It would be good for them.
Oh, hell, are you going to let that dame talk you into letting the richest country on earth slip through your fingers? Said Cuffy Maggs, leaping to his feet. It's a fine time to give up a whole continent. And in exchange for what? For a dinky little state that's milk dry anyway. I say ditch Minnesota, but hold on to your transcontinental dragnet. With trouble and riots everywhere, you won't be able to keep people in line unless you have transportation. Troop transportation. Unless you hold your soldiers within a few days' journey of any point on the continent. This is no time to retrench. Don't get yellow listening to all that talk. You've got the country in your pocket. Just keep it there.
In the long run, Mouch started uncertainly.
In the long run, we'll all be dead, snapped Cuffy Meggs. He was pacing restlessly. Retrenching hell. There's plenty of pickings left in California and Oregon and all those places. What I've been thinking is, we ought to think of expanding. The way things are, there's nobody to stop us. It's there for the taking. Mexico and Canada, maybe. It ought to be a cinch.
Then she saw the answer. She saw the secret premise behind their words. With all of their noisy devotion to the age of science, their hysterically technological jargon, their cyclotrons, their sound rays, these men were moved forward not by the image of an industrial skyline, but by the vision of that form of existence which the industrialists had swept away. The vision of a fat, unhygienic Rajah of India, with vacant eyes staring in indolent stupor out of stagnant layers of flesh, with nothing to do but run precious gems through his fingers and, once in a while, stick a knife into the body of a starved, toil-dazed, germ-eaten creature as a claim to a few grains of the creature's rice, then claim it from hundreds of millions of such creatures and thus let the rice grains gather into gems. She had thought that industrial production was a value not to be questioned by anyone. She had thought that these men's urge to expropriate the factories of others was their acknowledgement of the factory's value. She, born of the Industrial Revolution, had not held as conceivable, had forgotten, along with the tales of astrology and alchemy, what these men knew in their secret furtive souls, knew not by means of thought, but by means of that nameless muck which they called their instincts and emotions. That so long as men struggle to stay alive, they'll never produce so little but that the man with the club won't be able to seize it and leave them still less, provided millions of them are willing to submit. That the harder their work and the less their gain, the more submissive the fiber of their spirit. That men who live by pulling levers at an electric switchboard are not easily ruled, but men who live by digging the soil with their naked fingers are. That the feudal baron did not need electronic factories in order to drink his brains away out of jeweled goblets, and neither did the rajahs of the People's State of India. She saw what they wanted, and to what goal their instincts, which they called unaccountable, were leading them. She saw that Eugene Lawson, the humanitarian, took pleasure at the prospect of human starvation, and Dr. Ferris, the scientist, was dreaming of the day when men would return to the hand plow. Incredulity and indifference were her only reaction. Incredulity, because she could not conceive of what would bring human beings to such a state. Indifference, because she could not regard those who reached it as human any longer. They went on talking, but she was unable to speak or to listen. She caught herself feeling that her only desire was now to get home and fall asleep.
"Miss Taggart," said a politely rational, faintly anxious voice, and jerking her head up, she saw the courteous figure of a waiter. "The assistant manager of the Taggart terminal is on the telephone, requesting permission to speak to you at once. He says it's an emergency."
It was a relief to leap to her feet and get out of that room, even if in answer to the call of some new disaster. It was a relief to hear the assistant manager's voice, even though it was saying, "The interlocker system is out, Miss Taggart. The signal's dead. There are 8 incoming trains held up and 6 outgoing. We can't move them in or out of the tunnels. We can't find the chief engineer. We can't locate the breach of the circuit. We have no copper wire for repairs. We don't know what to do. I'll be right down," she said, dropping the receiver. Hurrying to the elevator, then half running through the stately lobby of the Wayne Falkland, she felt herself returning to life at the summons of the possibility of action. Taxicabs were rare these days, and none came in answer to the doorman's whistle. She started rapidly down the street, forgetting what she wore, wondering why the touch of the wind seemed too cold and too intimately close. Her mind on the terminal ahead, she was startled by the loveliness of a sudden sight. She saw the slender figure of a woman hurrying toward her, the ray of a lamppost sweeping over lustrous hair, naked arms, the swirl of a black cape and the flame of a diamond on her breast, with the long, empty corridor of a city street behind her and skyscrapers drawn by lonely dots of light. The knowledge that she was seeing her own reflection in the side mirror of a florist's window came an instant too late. She had felt the enchantment of the full context to which that image and city belonged. Then she felt a stab of desolate loneliness, much wider a loneliness than the span of an empty street, and a stab of anger at herself, at the preposterous contrast between her appearance and the context of this night and age. She saw a taxi turn a corner. She waved to it and leaped in, slamming the door against a feeling which she hoped to leave behind her, on the empty pavement by a florist's window. But she knew, in self-mockery, in bitterness, in longing, that this feeling was the sense of expectation she had felt at her first ball, and at those rare times when she had wanted the outward beauty of existence to match its inner splendor. "What a time to think of it," she told herself in mockery. "Not now," she cried to herself in anger. But a desolate voice kept asking her quietly to the rattle of the taxi's wheels, "You who believed you must live for your happiness, what do you now have left of it? What are you gaining from your struggle? Yes, say it honestly. What's in it for you? Or are you becoming one of those abject altruists who has no answer to that question any longer?" "Not now," she ordered, as the glowing entrance to the Taggart terminal flared up in the rectangle of the taxi's windshield. The men in the terminal manager's office were like extinguished signals, as if here, too, a circuit were broken and there were no living current to make them move. They looked at her with a kind of inanimate passivity, as if it made no difference whether she let them stay still or threw a switch to set them in motion. The terminal manager was absent. The chief engineer could not be found. He had been seen at the terminal 2 hours ago, not since. The assistant manager had exhausted his power of initiative by volunteering to call her. The others volunteered nothing. The signal engineer was a college boyish man in his 30s who kept saying aggressively, "But this has never happened before, Miss Taggart. The interlocker has never failed. It's not supposed to fail. We know our jobs. We can take care of it as well as anybody can, but not if it breaks down when it's not supposed to." She could not tell whether the dispatcher, an elderly man with years of railroad work behind him, still retained his intelligence but chose to hide it, or whether months of suppressing it had choked it for good, granting him the safety of stagnation. "We don't know what to do, Miss Taggart. We don't know whom to call for what sort of permission. There are no rules to cover an emergency of this kind. There aren't even any rules about who's to lay down the rules for it." She listened. She reached for the telephone without a word of explanation. She ordered the operator to get her the operating vice president of the Atlantic Southern in Chicago, to get him at his home and out of bed if necessary. "George, Dagny Taggart," she said, when the voice of her competitor came on the line. "Will you lend me the signal engineer of your Chicago terminal, Charles Murray, for 24 hours? "Yes." "Right. Put him aboard a plane and get him here as fast as you can. Tell him we'll pay $3,000. "Yes, for the one day." "Yes, as bad as that." "Yes, I'll pay him in cash, out of my own pocket if necessary.
I'll pay whatever it takes to bribe his way aboard a plane, but get him on the first plane out of Chicago. No, George, not one. Not a single mind left on Taggart Transcontinental. Yes, I'll get all the papers, exemptions, exceptions, and emergency permissions. Thanks, George. So long.
She hung up and spoke rapidly to the men before her, not to hear the stillness of the room and of the terminal, where no sound of wheels was beating any longer, not to hear the bitter words which the stillness seemed to repeat. Not a single mind left on Taggart Transcontinental.
Get wrecking train and crew ready at once, she said. Send them out on the Hudson line with orders to tear down every foot of copper wire, any copper wire, lights, signals, telephone, everything that's company property. Have it here by morning.
But Miss Taggart, our service on the Hudson line is only temporarily suspended, and the Unification Board has refused us permission to dismantle the line.